WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In theater circles, he is a guru, regarded with an awe that borders on the religious. That's how my guest Peter Brook was once described in The Atlantic magazine. Peter Brook is a former director of the Royal Shakespeare Company in London. He adapted several of his most acclaimed theater productions for the screen, including Marat Sade, King Lear, and Carmen. He also directed the films Meetings with Remarkable Men and the 1963 version of The Lord of the Flies. For over a decade, Brook has been absorbed in bringing the Mahabharata to the stage and screen. The Mahabharata is a sacred Indian text written in Sanskrit. It's over 200 years old and over 10 times the length of the Bible. It's part myth, part history, part religious text, telling the story of the creation of mankind. The theater version was 9 hours long. I spoke with Brook when the 3-hour film adaptation opened in New York last April. It's now playing in Boston and Los Angeles. Peter Brook told me how we first encountered the Mahabharata.
I was doing a show in London about this country called US, which was about the Vietnam War, and we called it US Us because it was about the relation between the English and the Americans and Vietnam. And we were all very concerned at that time, and one day a young Indian came into rehearsal and dropped into my hands a tiny play he had written. And I looked at it, and it was just about one incident. I didn't even know at the time that he came from the Mahabharata, which was about a great general who, just as he's about to give the signal to launch a battle that could lead to the extermination of all mankind, stopping in his tracks and asking himself this great question, why should we fight? And we wanted to incorporate it in our show, and we couldn't. But this powerful image remained with me, and then gradually over the years I learned, first of all, that this was the center of the great sacred book of India called the Bhagavad Gita. And then Jean-Claude Carrière, the writer who was working with me in Paris, and I learned from a great French Sanskrit scholar that the Bhagavad Gita, in its turn, is just the culminating point in an enormous epic poem called the Mahabharata.
Did you ever end up going back to the text itself and reading it in English translation?
Oh, of course. So after this, Jean-Claude Carrière, we were both very excited by this, and he was fired to write a play, and he wrote a short play entirely based on what we'd heard. We looked at it and then realized that this was just a sketch. We had to go into it more seriously, and then began many years of work where we sat together and read through the entire 18 volumes in English translation, the same in an incomplete 19th century French translation, and then read many different shortened versions, went to India, compared versions, talked to scholars, talked to people in the street, listened to storytellers, and gradually, in that way, got sufficiently drenched in the material for Jean-Claude 10 years later to begin to write the full script. And we made one vow. We said we're not going to fix a time limit, either on the time it will take to write it or the time that the show should take. We will let it find its natural shape. And its natural shape was 9 hours, and its natural divisions were in 3 parts.
Yeah, the theatrical version was 9 hours. I mean, a theatrical production of that length has certain advantages in the sense that you clear away everything else from your life to go see this because you have to create a whole day. It becomes an event, a kind of holiday from life to immerse yourself in this theatrical event. On the other hand, there's certain disadvantages. First of all, who has the time to do that? And it takes a certain physical stamina to spend most of the day sitting in one chair. In a theater, what were your considerations about producing something of that length, both in terms of what it would take out of the actors and what it would require from the audience?
I didn't give a thought to either of those. I only thought of one thing, which is that the Mahabharata is a great and important work, and suddenly we're in the privileged position of being able to bring it to people who don't know anything about it, after which Darwin's laws of natural selection operate, that in each city where we played it, it was always crammed to the roofs by natural selection. In other words, there were people, and I would be one of them. I think if I'd been just a member of the public, would say, oh my God, I can't go to a theatre and sit there for 9 hours. I wouldn't have gone to see it if I hadn't been connected with it. And many people followed the line of thinking you've just brought up and said, we won't go. But luckily, there were other people who said, this interests us, this attracts us, we are going to make the effort. And always, when you make an effort, you're rewarded.
Theater and film director Peter Brook is my guest, and his theatrical production of the Mahabharata has been adapted into a new film version. This isn't the first time you've brought one of your theater productions to film. No. Can you discuss some of your considerations when you're adapting something you've already done on stage? You don't want to just film the stage production.
No. I mean, the first thing is to realize that it's a completely different medium. It's a different language. And I've always enjoyed it. I've always found it a very, very fascinating technical challenge. In a way, if you're taking a subject and starting from zero, which I've done in other films, you construct the whole film in a quite different way. If you're starting from something that has already had existence in the theatre, first of all, you have a great leap ahead because you've got something that's been well prepared. The actors are well prepared. Lots of the scenes have been really worked over and brought into their best form. So there is a good starting point. On the other hand, it is in theatre form. So what's one trying to do? Now, when I made the film of the Mahabharata, of the Marasad, the aim was to see how one could put onto the screen the sensation of being in the audience, not what it would be like to stick a camera in the stalls, because if you stuck a camera in the stalls, you wouldn't get the sensation of being in the audience. You'd just see a flat picture, which would give you everything except that sensation. So here we had to use highly cinematic devices with a camera constantly on the move and a very complex cutting structure to give the physical sensation of being part of that performance. Now, the Mahabharata is slightly different because the Mahabharata is a narrative. And what I wanted to do was I chose to do it in a studio rather than on real locations to be able to capture something that goes right back to the origins of the cinema, which is that particular thing that only a film studio can give as a dream factory, a form of cinema such as, what can I say, there have been many studio films going right back, say, to The Wizard of Oz, that are not realistic and at the same time are not theatre. They're part of that particular great magic of the cinema which belongs to studio. And that was the basis on which we made the Mahabharata film.
Now, your movie, The Mahabharata, is 3 hours, whereas the stage production was 9 hours. Is the scaling down in time economical, or does it have to do with the differences between theater and film?
There are two versions. There is a television version of 6 hours, which is going to be aired, I think, in a year's time, mm-hmm. and which has been shown already all over the world, and specifically a film version. The 6 hours is exactly the same, really, as the 9 hours, surprisingly. There you see the difference between theatre speed and film speed, that exactly the same scenes, just because you're in closer with the actors don't have to walk in and walk off. The fact that you can cut right into the middle of a phrase in the cinema, and the fact that because you're in big close-up, everything can be done with less force, and consequently it all goes quicker, means that you can lose a couple of hours without even cutting a line. And with little trimming, we got 9 hours down to 6 hours with no problem. Then came the other challenge, which was to make a purely cinematic film. And here the approach was different. It was no longer trying, as in the full version, to tell the whole story. It was to give a very, very intense impression of what the Mahabharata is. So I'd compare it much more with finding yourself in the center of a maze or of one of those hall of mirrors in funfairs, where you see an extraordinary amount of strange images leaving you in different directions. And the aim is not to spell everything out. The aim is to give you a quite bewildering, kaleidoscopic, but very intense impression of what this great, almost unknown, many-leveled work from several thousand years ago called the Mahabharata is.
There's a lot of talk today about multiculturalism and multiculturalism in the arts. Back in 1968, you formed an international theater group in Paris, which you still had, the International Center of Theater Research.
Yes.
And you've been working with actors from around the world. I think 36 countries are represented in the cast of your new movie. What was it you wanted to learn by creating such an international cast to work with?
Something very simple. I feel that all of us, every human being, is incomplete. And the world's tragedies come from the moments when we think that we are complete and everybody else is incomplete. But the moment we realize that we're all unfinished bits in a giant jigsaw, we can see that there is something infinitely precious that we can gain if we can make a living and working relationship with people very different from ourselves. If we're with people who are very much like ourselves and we have the same beliefs, the same ideas, we become a clan and eventually an arrogant clan that really does believe that it's complete. If we're with people who in every way are different but whom we can respect because we see that they are human beings like ourselves, but they have different possibilities, a different understanding. Their strengths are different from ours. Their weaknesses are different from ours. Then through a very hard, specific program, which is of working together, not just sitting loving one another and making universal brotherhoods, but hard, practical work for a purpose, which is, say, producing a play so that people can actually pay money to go and see it. When you have that to bind you together, gradually these incomplete bits open up and something is shared by everyone, and each person is enriched by the experience, and so is the result.
Let's talk practically for a minute, though, when you have people from different countries who represent different languages, who will have different accents when they speak English, who, because of their skin tones, are obviously from different cultures and different parts of the world. Can you create a naturalistic play where everybody's of the same family or everybody's from the same background? Do you know what I mean? If that's required of the text.
I think that this is the real and extraordinary miracle that the theatre can achieve, that ever all through history, when acting has been powerful enough, it can sell anything to an audience, and the audience is delighted to buy it. The simplest example is that many old actresses, and particularly one reads Sarah Bernhardt when she was old and had and limped, still managed to convey to an audience that she was a young girl or that she was a young man by the power of her acting. And the moment that you sweep away this very, very false notion that has only recently crept into the theatre, that the theatre should be like a photograph of everyday life, and you realise that theatre is a platform or a space in which an actor is like a storyteller, conjuring up something for the imagination of the audience, you can see that an old man can play a young girl, that a black man can play a young white man, or a Japanese can play an English hero, that these all depend on the power of the talent and the conviction of the actors. When this succeeds, the audience is touched in a new way.
When you got out of college, you wanted to make movies. You wanted to direct, but you ended up directing theater first instead of film. Why did you want to do film over theater, but why did you end up actually starting in theater?
I've always liked films. I mean, it's been my first great passion along with photography, and it never occurred to me for a moment that I'd work in the theater. I made a film when I was at college, when I was, I think, 18 or 19, and then went into films, and I worked in films as various sorts of assistant, but all I wanted to do was to make my own film. And I went from one producer to another, but particularly in those days, nobody would dream of giving a 19, 20-year-old young man a film to direct, and I was impatient, very impatient. And I turned to the theatre as a sort of quick, cheap substitute. And even there it wasn't easy because the big theatres said exactly the same thing. They said, come back another day, come back when you've done something somewhere else. Until in the end I found a theatre so tiny where the production cost was so low that they really took no risk at all in letting an unknown young man do a play there. And from then onwards, that has really been the balance. I mean, I have, in the course of it, got as interested, as passionately involved as in the theatre as in the cinema, but what has made it possible for me to do about 60 productions in the theatre and make 10 films is that, as I've never wanted to do a commercial film, and I've always wanted to do just the subjects that interested me, as in the theatre I can get, could always get, a project going in a few weeks, and the same sort of project in the cinema would take a few years.
So you never wanted to make conventional movies? You never wanted to do a Western or a detective story or
no.
a comedy?
No, I
romance.
Love going to see them. Uh-huh. And in fact, I've never wanted to do what I've seen other people do well.
You thought you had something else that was your calling?
Yes, when I've seen a Western, I mean, I've seen marvelous Westerns, and having seen, say, John Ford make a Western, the last thing I want to do is to go into rivalry with him. I'd rather go and see one of his films once again and do something quite different.
You've directed many actors during your career. You once wrote about directing John Gielgud, and you said, you know, Gielgud is a great actor. He has so many ideas. In a way, he has too many ideas, and that your job as a director became focusing those ideas, limiting those ideas. What are some of the other things what is the flexibility of in your role of director, depending on who it is that you are directing? I mean, do you have to become a different kind of director depending on who the actor is?
You know, there's a director really has got two possibilities, and both of them are equally strong. One of them is intervening, and the other is listening. And if you intervene all the time and don't listen and watch sufficiently, then you become the sort of director that one doesn't really admire, which is a director who is all the time imposing himself and who's using other people as a way of imposing his ideas. If, on the other hand, you are too passive and you watch and you listen and you're too gentle and too broad-minded and you fail to intervene when intervention is desperately needed, you become a weak director. So there isn't a rule. One spends all one's time between those two possibilities, depending on the actor. Some actors you have to intervene occasionally. Some you have to intervene tactfully. Sometimes, very rarely, you have to intervene very drastically, forcefully, and even brutally. But those are extreme measures that you really want to avoid. And most of the time, you're in between all of those things, listening to the actor, watching how he's developing, seeing where he is going right and righter than you ever expected. And so all you need to do there is to encourage him, or where you see him, without knowing it, beginning to slip away from what he himself wants to do. And there you can help him recover.
We've mentioned theater and film. You've also directed a lot of operas, but I think you kind of left opera.
Yeah.
A while ago.
Slamming the door.
Yeah, why?
I left opera for something like 25 years until we did Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was very simple. I realized that in the conditions of big opera houses, it was impossible to do really good work because there's a system. And a system is like a political system. It's like a system that's been in Eastern Europe, that if you had a choice between becoming a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe or going your own way in the West, I think that very few people would deliberately choose to become a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe. And exactly the same way, if you have a free choice between directing in sympathetic, good, quiet conditions with actors who are interested, who have egos but are not dominated by them and who really wish to share their work to make a good result, or to go into the opera house where you have impossibly short rehearsals, union clashes all the time, hysterical, over-important, ego-devoured singers unwilling to rehearse, greedy because they can get more money by rushing from one part of the world to another with a minimum of rehearsal, doing the maximum of high-powered, of highly overpriced performances, you realize that you must be mad to prefer to work in those rotten conditions than to work with them. On the other hand, opera is a great form, and singers can be marvelous people. So I made a very simple vow. I would never work in a great opera house, but I would do an opera the moment it was possible to bring together a group of really dedicated young singers and musicians within our own theater, where we have none of these horrifying structural blocks that almost every big institution is bound to suffer from, whether it wants to do so or not.
When you were at Oxford University, you founded the Film Society there. What did you do in it?
First of all, we showed films. We showed great silent films that people had heard about, you know, the great Russian films and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and the Dreyer films and Murnau films that we knew about as legendary pictures, but we had no other way of seeing. And then we made a film. We made a film called A Sentimental Journey from Lawrence Stern's book, which we shot in the middle of war with incredible difficulty, with the only film we could find, which was rejected camera gun film that the RAF didn't use, so they just sold a sort of bulk lots of sort of largely dud negative. And I, in wartime, it was forbidden to use any laboratory for amateur work. So I found a little man in London who was illegally making pornographic films. And so to do this, he had to have his own laboratory because he couldn't send his films to anyone else to process. And I came to an arrangement with him to develop our films for us. And it was in those sort of conditions we made our first film.
That's interesting. Did you ever watch his movies?
No, but he was a very sweet man, and he kept saying to me, one of these days I must show you. He'd look at our film, and he said, that's very good. I'm sure that one of my films you would enjoy most of all, which was called Wood Nymph, and this became a legend. He'd always say to me, well, Mr. Brooke, he said, one of these days I'll show you Wood Nymph, but I'm afraid he never did.
I have one last question for you. What's your prescription for a healthy theater?
To stop thinking that the theater can be even discussed in these broad generalizations.
Uh-huh.
Each single act of theater is a new event, and what's healthy is to make the most of that event without ever imagining that the theater as a whole is going to get better or going to get worse or change its direction, because the theater as a whole is always going to be an extraordinary mixture, a great hodgepodge in which each person can only take responsibility for his little corner of it and cultivate his own field as best he can.
Theater and film director Peter Brook. His film adaptation of the Mahabharata is now showing in Boston and Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.